This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKean. U.S. senators at Donald Trump's historic second impeachment trial are being reminded of last month's Capitol riot through a graphic video. AP correspondent Sagar Magani with those details.
Trump's lawyers argued the Senate has no jurisdiction now that he's out of office. But after nearly 4 hours of presentations, six Republicans joined Democrats in voting the trial is constitutional. There was an emotional appeal from House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin, who tearfully described his kids being in the Capitol during a riot he says Trump incited. Future presidents have to know they can't get away with it.
This cannot be the future of America.
Trump lawyer David Schoen took on a partisan tone, accusing Democrats of being less concerned with the Constitution and more with getting rid of Trump and his backers.
Seeking to eliminate Donald Trump from the American political scene.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
A top ally of imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has announced a new type of anti-government protest, urging residents of big cities to briefly gather in residential courtyards this weekend with their cell phone lights on. Navalny's strategist Leonid Volkov said Tuesday the protest will start 8 p.m. Sunday and last about 15 minutes. He says a new format could prevent Russian police from interfering and allows anyone to participate. Navalny is Russian President Vladimir Putin's most determined critic. His arrest last month sparked nationwide protest, with tens of thousands rallying across Russia for two weekends. More than 11,000 people have been arrested and hundreds have been handed jail terms in an unprecedented crackdown on demonstrators. This is VOA News. The head of the World Health Organization-led team probing the origins of COVID-19 said bats remain a likely source and that transmission of the virus via frozen food is a possibility that warrants further investigation, but he ruled out a lab leak. The Peter Benenberg, who led the team of independent experts, and its nearly month-long visit to the Chinese city of Wuhan, where the outbreak first emerged at a seafood market in late 2019, said the team's work had uncovered new information, but had not dramatically changed their picture of the outbreak. He said work to identify the coronavirus's origins points to a natural reservoir in bats, but it is unlikely that they were in Wuhan. Investigators were also looking for Chinese blood samples that could indicate that the virus was circulating earlier than first thought. China has pushed the idea that the virus can be transmitted by frozen food and has repeatedly announced findings of coronavirus traces on imported food packaging. Facebook is vowing to take extra steps to block the spread of bogus claims about the coronavirus vaccines. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
As inoculation efforts ramp up around the world, Facebook says it's going all in to stop false reports, like claims that vaccines aren't effective or they're toxic, dangerous, or cause autism. Last year, the company banned paid ads that discourage vaccinations, with one exception for advocacy ads about government vaccine policies. But even as Facebook cracks down, there are still private groups and there are Instagram influence peddlers. The watchdog group Center for Countering Digital Hate says millions of people are being fed dangerous lies, which lead them to doubt government guidance and helps prolong the pandemic. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The pilot's poor decisions are blamed in Kobe Bryant's chopper crash, AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
Thomas Chapman is a member of the NTSB.
The probable cause of this accident was the pilot's decision to continue flight under visual flight rules into instrument meteorological conditions, which resulted in the pilot's spatial disorientation and loss of control.
And Chapman adds the pilot really wanted to get Kobe Bryant to a youth basketball event.
Contributing to the accident was the pilot's likely self-induced pressure and the pilot's planned continuation bias, which adversely affected his decision-making.
And NTSB Chairman Robert Sumwalt adds,
there were opportunities along the way to have reversed the course and prevented this crash by simply landing.
I'm Shelley Adler.
And I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Families of missing Ugandan opposition supporters demand answers from their government.
And in any of the cells of our security agencies, and I've also instructed that those people arrested should, if they feel they were a threat to security, must be brought before the courts.
UNICEF supports the health ministry in DRC amid new Ebola case. Doctors Without Borders on providing health care in southwest Cameroon amidst the insurrection. We'll tell you how Kenyan performers are making a living during COVID-19 restrictions. And Coca-Cola South Africa is giving its workers a 15% share in the company.
It's very special because it recognizes the value that our employees play in the future of the business and the sustainability of the business.
And branding or making the Liberian country club more fashionable. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There's a growing outcry in Uganda from relatives of missing opposition supporters who were detained by security forces ahead of last month's general election. As Halima Athumani reports from Kampala, the government confirms 44 people have gone missing since November, and the most are from the opposition National Unity Platform Party of Bobi Wine.
On November 23rd, Mary Namuyanja's husband, Lukwago Martin, was picked up by Ugandan military personnel at his fish stall in Bugolobi Market. More than 2 months later, Namuyanja, who could not hold back her tears, says she still cannot find her husband, even after searching police stations and hospitals. She says, "The children ask me about their father every day. I don't know what to tell them." She says, "I have a little one. They are always falling ill. I have no money to take care of them. Please help me." Namuyanja pleads, "Wherever he is, bring him back." She says, "If he committed any crime, let them take him to court so I can know what's going on. But I don't even know where he is." A week after Martin was taken away, relatives say security personnel picked up two mechanics near the market, including Nanyonga Aaron's husband, Nalumosa Vincent. She says he is still missing. She says, "We are in so much pain. The government should help us. My husband committed no crime." Nanyonga says he was not among the protesters. They found him working on a motorcycle, she says. On the day of Martin's detention, 10 other men in the market were also rounded up, including Okumu Charles. He says they were forced into a Toyota van and tortured before some were let go. He says some, like Martin, were picked up because of their association with the opposition National Unity Platform Party, NUP. Okumu says, "Because Lukwago Martin was a member of NUP, and he was always with our councillor who stood on the NUP ticket. He says they were always together. The ones who were arrested in the garage, the mechanic, Vincent, he was the NUP mobilizer in the Bugolobi area," Okumu says. "The other young man, Agaba Ronald, who was arrested, was a strong supporter of NUP, and he did not miss any of the NUP meetings," Okumu says. After earlier denying the kidnappings, Uganda's internal minister, General Jeje Odong, on Thursday released the names of 44 people reported missing around the country. Major General Paul Lokech, Deputy Inspector General Police, says he has instructed the heads of criminal investigations and intelligence to give him the names of the 44.
"And I've also instructed that those people arrested should, if they feel they were a threat to security, must be brought before the courts."
As the government investigates, Ugandan media reports say relatives of opposition supporters continue to report their loved ones missing after they were taken away by authorities. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Last week, armed men fired on Doctors Without Borders ambulance in southwest Cameroon and injured at least one healthcare worker. Doctors Without Borders has been working in the region since 2017. Paolo Milanisio, a spokesperson for the organization, says the needs of area residents suffer when healthcare workers are attacked.
On the early morning of the 4th of February this week, we had a call very early our ambulance was reaching to the place, to the pickup point in Muyuka area in the southwest region, the ambulance was attacked. And the nurse that was next to the driver was injured. So that means that the ambulance continued and was not able to stop to pick up the patient. A second ambulance was dispatched later, and finally we succeed in pick up, in collecting the patient and taking him to the hospital, right?
Can you tell me a little bit about the context of what's going on in that region of Cameroon and what kind of healthcare issues people in that area are facing?
The crisis starts, almost like 700,000 people are internally displaced in this area. So what we are providing healthcare for this emergency through three main activities or pickups, okay? Our main one is community health workers. Community health workers are volunteers from the communities that are selected by their own communities and the leaders of the communities to be the representatives of the community in terms of health services. So these people are volunteer people that we train for them to give the most basic health care, okay? When these people walk around the community and walk around the bush trying to find a patient, they are able to give the most basic services as malaria or controlling diarrhea. But when they cannot provide more than that, or when they need to provide more than that, they will refer these patients to the main towns where we support secondary structures.
Given the fact that this crisis in southwest and northwest Cameroon has kind of been going on for years now, has MSF seen the situation for residents in the region deteriorate or improve?
What we can check is that the communities are still in need. So we cannot analyze the conflict, we cannot analyze the reasons, but what we can see is that still the communities are in need. Needs are growing, and it's not just in terms of health, in terms of a lot of basic needs that these displaced people have no cover, you know. We keep on working hard and expanding activity because, unfortunately, the health needs and, as I said, other basic needs are not covered.
What are, at this moment, some of the most pressing health needs in the region?
The problem here is that the health system is totally collapsed. We have a lot of people escaping due to violence, and they are not able to reach to health facilities, or the health facilities are empty. So what we find here is that there is lack of services. So when we arrive to these communities, to whatever location where communities are hiding, escaping from violence, we need to provide the most basic malaria treatment to support deliveries or whatever needs in terms of trauma.
That was Paulo Milanicio, head of Doctors Without Borders Mission in Cameroon. He was speaking with Ricky Stryak from Southwest Cameroon. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is working to support the Ministry of Health in the Democratic Republic of Congo after a new case of Ebola was detected in an area where a previous outbreak was declared in June 2020. Mavis Ochre has more from Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
The Butembo branch of the National Institute of Biomedical Research confirmed Ebola in samples taken from a patient with Ebola-like symptoms who had sought treatment at a local health center. The woman who has died was the wife of an Ebola survivor. Butembo, in North Kivu province, was one of the centers of the previous Ebola outbreak in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Jean Metenier, senior coordinator for UNICEF in Goma, says it is not unusual for sporadic cases to occur following a major outbreak. He says Ebola survivors carry the potential risks of infecting people who were not affected by the Ebola crisis earlier.
This is why we have a very study program to monitor the survivors of the Ebola outbreak in order to ensure that they are regularly followed up and to measure the capacity of infecting other people. Fortunately, this person has been tested several times and came back negative. So we are investigating the situation to understand why we've been tested and reported negative. He has been infected with SARS.
He says Ebola survivors carry the potential risk of infecting people who were not affected by the Ebola crisis earlier. He says his organization has deployed a team to Butembo to help the Ministry of Health identify and trace those who came into contact with the patients to ensure that they are not infected. Metinia says they have started transporting medical equipment and supplies to the affected area.
At the same time, we are currently mobilizing the community, their communication channels, in order to inform them about the situation and to ensure that people know what are the basic hygiene procedures which we need to follow in order to avoid to be contaminated themselves.
He says people should report to health facilities to be examined immediately when they suspect they have symptoms of Ebola and should not wait until the situation gets out of control before seeking assistance.
People should be taking precautionary measures at the village, at the hospital level, in order to avoid any potential contamination. And if people are basically starting to have some symptoms like fever and starting to have some bleeding, they should immediately be reporting to medical facilities so they can be taken care immediately. We should not avoid to have people waiting the last minute in order to report to medical facilities, because it's going to be very, very difficult to provide them the adequate treatment.
He says UNICEF already has some medical supplies stored in Beni and Butembo and is organizing shipments of additional equipment and supplies to the affected area, North Kivu, Ituri, and South Kivu provinces, where hit by the world's second deadliest outbreak of Ebola in August 2018. It lasted 23 months and killed 2,287 people and infected 3,470, with children making up about 28% of all cases. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jassu in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February the 10th. Coca-Cola Beverages South Africa, a bottler for the Coca-Cola Company, is giving workers a 15% share in the company. These shares, plus those already held by black investors, will increase the black ownership to 20%. This was a black economic empowerment condition set down by competition authorities who have scrutinized a merger of three bottling companies. Vicky Stark has more.
Starting on International Workers' Day on May 1st, 8,000 employees at Coca-Cola Beverages South Africa could start seeing the benefits of this deal. That's according to the company's managing director, Velapi Rachefolo. He says staff members were already getting 5% of the shares, and now, to adhere to the BEE requirements of the merger deal, they've increased that to 15%. Rachefolo won't say how much the deal is worth, but stresses that it's vendor-driven, meaning workers won't have to lay out any cash. And he says if there are profits, workers will be paid dividends every quarter.
It's very special because it recognizes the value that our employees play in the future of the business and the sustainability of the business.
Rachefolo says workers will also be represented at the highest level of decision-making.
We've engaged with the trade unions throughout the journey, and the employees will have an opportunity to appoint two independent trustees who will serve in the board so that they can shape the long future of the business going forward. So I am very excited.
South Africa's Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, Ibrahim Patel, has been involved in the negotiations. He praised the model and says it's something he heard about from German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
When Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, was in South Africa in February last year, in fact, almost exactly a year ago, she hosted a meeting with President Ramaphosa and the German and South African business community. And the issue of how to deal with all the challenges of inclusivity had come up. And in the course of that conversation, she had indicated how valuable Germany found the participation of workers on company boards. We have a lot to learn. We are engaged now in discussions with Corporate South Africa on how to take these ideas forward.
Coca-Cola Beverages SA has also agreed to contribute 80 million rand a year for 3 years to localization initiatives that form part of national efforts to rebuild the economy. Lastly, the company says it will work with its sugar suppliers to increase the amount of sugarcane bought from black farmers. Patel says these are important steps in efforts to create a more inclusive economy in South Africa. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
With COVID-19 guidelines prohibiting large audiences, some Kenyan performers have taken to the streets to earn a living. One group, the Clan Acrobats, has been entertaining motorists stuck in traffic with juggling, balancing, and tumbling. Mortgage Rishwayo reports from Nairobi.
Being stuck in Nairobi's notorious traffic can be boring. A troop of acrobats calling themselves the Clan is making it much more interesting. As a captive audience watches from their cars, they flip, jump, and stack themselves up into a human pyramid. Lockdown measures meant to stop the spread of COVID-19 barred them from performing at restaurants and hotels. Brian Mugo, who's the founder of the group, says the restrictions hit them hard.
Us like acrobats, we deal with gathering, where people should gather. We entertain the big crowds. Now, due to this COVID-19, people can't gather together.
Late last year, Kenya lifted certain restrictions, and it was then that the group started performing on Nairobi's busy intersections. At the end of each act, one of them runs through the traffic, collecting donations from entertained drivers.
Thank you.
The Clan Acrobats are managing to get by. Some motorists are concerned about the risk they take performing in the traffic. Others appreciate their presence.
The good thing is they're waiting for the traffic lights when they are red, yeah? That's when they do the thing. When the traffic lights are green, they move.
COVID-19 restrictions in Kenya led to millions of people losing their jobs as the enforced lockdown caused the economy to contract. Unemployment has doubled since then. Austin Otieno works for an organization that helps young people find employment and start their own businesses. He says that the effect of job and income losses for young people is grave.
There's no job currently in Kenya. Whether you have certificates, you see majority of us, and even these guys that you see on the street doing acrobats, some of them have good certificates. The acrobats currently, they are just left like to beg on the streets. There's no a formal way of how they can be put, and there's a way like they can get their livelihood.
After a long day performing in traffic, the Clan Acrobats return to their neighborhood where they train young and aspiring acrobats after school. They meet in an open field. One of them is 10-year-old Alvin Miheso. He started training when he was in the first grade. Alvin says when he's older, he will use his acrobatics to raise money for poor people. He says, I want to be an acrobat when I'm older because it is my talent. I want to earn money so that I can help poor people. In the meantime, the Clan Acrobats plan to keep performing for motorists while they wait for a green light on pandemic restrictions to be lifted. Muge Lwahlatshwayo for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Liberia, the traditional country cloth, woven usually by hand by indigenous people, is mostly worn by important people such as chiefs and dignitaries. A gown made from country cloth is usually given to foreign diplomats in recognition of their services to Liberia. Now, there is an effort to brand, urbanize, and make the country cloth more fashionable. Emeka Obiamewe and Kathy Eastman are partners of Maja Collection in the state of Maryland, USA.
So, for starters, Manja means chief, boss, leader. So for us, Manja means royalty. We're trying to showcase our brand in a different manner, especially the African textiles. So the country cloth is usually used in traditional wear. So we're trying to give a little fresh take to cross over our fabric, because that's important. So not only us Africans or us Liberians can celebrate our wares, but to encourage others to see our wares in different lights, our fabrics in different lights.
I hear people call this country cloth. What is the origin of this name, country cloth?
I think I would like to speak to that. The whole idea in 2021, calling it country cloth, while other countries have a brand name, we have to look beyond that, and that's what we're trying to do. Like we say, Manja Collection is what we're trying to do, clothes, apparel, home items. We would like to brand, and in the next few months, we're going to work with artists, we're going to work with fabric maker to create a brand, Manja, like how would you see Kente from Ghana, Asha Oke from Nigeria. But the uniqueness of it all is, Liberia has been out of the whole fashion industry apparel. People go to Liberia, it's one Chinese cup with the flag of Liberia. That's the only thing. Even the country club, the way it's packaged, the way it's presented, the colors and everything. What we want to do now is, how can it be fresh? Our vache, our slippers, our dress. We want to urbanize what we wear to go places. And we hope to be in tune with fashion. In Liberia, we got seamstress, we got tailors. It's about time now that we got home-based designer. So this dream, the funds we're going to raise from this, is going to go towards a fashion and beauty institute in Liberia.
Too often, let's say, I travel to Liberia and I see officials only wearing this. Do you find this country club, it is becoming more popular or fashionable?
Yeah, I feel like African and tribal wear has become more fashionable, period, across the world. You can even see it in a lot of the Western cultures. So there are a lot of Western designers are getting influence and inspiration from our tribal fabrics. So it's becoming popular in that sense. Even you see anything African is popular in music, too, music and dance. So Africa is all the rage now. Not that it wasn't before, but it's in a different light. It almost has become even more cool to be African, to showcase African, to wear African, to dance African, to listen to African music. So it's become more popular where people are not afraid to wear African anymore. I remember being younger and being ashamed. Can you imagine? I'm ashamed to even say that right now, but I was ashamed to wear African gear. But now it has become even more cooler for us to embrace our culture. So it's becoming more popular. And the role that we play into that is to make it really fresh and approachable to show different aspects of our fabric. That's really, really important.
Can you describe some of the styles that you are making out of this country cloth here?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of, like Mecca mentioned earlier, it's been urbanized, some of it. But we also have some classic silhouettes. So we have some what we call fit and flare for the female. So it comes in, fit in the waist and flares out around the hips. We have long coats, short coats. We have a trench coat. A trench coat is a fashion staple. Wow. Put that with country club. I mean, come on now. This is for that person who wants something very unique, who's bold, has that confidence. So we did that. We have bomber jackets. We have some motorcycle-inspired jackets. We have some French of the Italian cut types of jackets, double-breasted jackets. So we really took some of the coats that we wear in our Western clothing and really refurbished it using our country cloth.
As a young man growing up, country club used to be associated with Parama Chiefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they were the leaders, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what Manja means. It means chief, yes. Leaders, boss.
Yeah, basically, we talk about the Parama Chiefs and thing. You know, the whole country club, the suiting, when you came out of the poorer or sender society, you wore it. You had to be somebody to wear country club. In the villages, everybody who wore country club was on that level. And the way it is the whole name Manja. What's Manja from? Manja is from the Va tribe, which means man. And where it is now, with men, with kings, with royalty. My grandmother is Gola Va Kema. Her mother is Gola. So what we did, we combine the two of them, and they all under the Mende kingdom. So the whole Mende kingdom, which is known all over Africa. So where it is now is culture. We're telling stories. These are hand woven. I would say this is organic. They weave it. They sew it with their hands, and they bring it out to you. So these are custom. These are hip fashion. But like we say, in the next few months, we're going to develop further. We're going to push the brand. We're going to go to country club. We're going to put it on different things. We're going to put it on dishes. We're going to put it into art. We're going to do everything about it.
Emeka Obiamewe and Kathy Eastman are partners of Magi Collection. They spoke with me from Hyattsville in the state of Maryland, USA. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a good day.